Welcome to the Kelly Cardenas podcast. On today's show, you guys are going to be blown away. And every one of you that has an excuse that thinks that you should continue on in your excuses, don't watch this episode. Turn it off right now, because every excuse that you've ever had in your entire life, this man that I'm going to share with you is going to take them all away. He's going to help you to understand what resilience is, but the real meaning of it, not the tagline of it, not the tagline of authenticity. We run around a world where people have bumper stickers and they have things that they say and mantras that they live by, but they've actually never gone through it. This guy is actually going through it, and that's why I'm so excited to be able to share him with you today. Incredible human being. I wish I would have been recording before we actually started recording, because the conversation I've been having with him is unbelievable. So buckle up, grab a notebook, grab some tissues, and I'll hold your belly because you're going to laugh a lot during this time too. But I cannot wait to introduce you to my friend Brian Bogert, incredible speaker, author, and just human being, a dad, and this guy is absolutely incredible. So why don't we get this party started?
Joe Graham.
Yes.
He's the one who brought us together to begin with, right?
Guy is amazing.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show, Mr. Brian Bogert. I call you Mr., but I feel that that's so formal because you make everyone feel like they can do it too, but most of us aren't going to be able to go through what you went through. So let's start it off, right? Let's ease into it. Tell me about Walmart, a paintbrush, a truck, and a mom who loves their son.
Yeah. The thing I first want to start with is I don't want anybody to compare themselves to my story, right? And I'll tell you why in a second. But it was August 10th, 1992. My mom, my brother, and I went to our local Walmart to literally get a one-inch paintbrush. We were completing a home improvement project. We'd moved back from England only about 6 months prior, and my parents found a rehab home. So we literally went to go finish a job. And well, we were in Australia and England when I was a little kid. So my dad used to have reps all over the world, and it caused us to move. And so it was a really fun experience. But as we're getting reestablished back into Arizona, right, we're going to fix this home. We breeze through the checkout line. We were totally set. Get up to the car, and I've got my left hand on the door handle waiting to get back and put that paintbrush to use. Anybody who's known me for more than about 5 minutes, like some people said, man, your accident gave you this big vigor for life. But like, I was born this way too, right? So I just wanted to get back and use it. This was back in the days before there was key fobs though, brother.
Okay.
So my mom had to like reach into her purse, grab her keys, stick them in the door, turn them, right? Before we could go on with our way.
I think we lost some of the people right then when you said that.
Totally, because they don't even know what that means anymore. Bro, like, right? And so my mom and brother are a couple of feet behind me. I'm waiting for her to catch up and do this. And while that happened, a truck pulls up in front of the Walmart and parks, and the driver and the middle passenger get out.
Did you see it? Did you see this?
I have zero recollection of the day, to be honest. What I'm telling you is I've heard the story a million times. I have zero recollection personally. Right? So no, I didn't see it, but that's the reality. They get out and the passenger all the way to the right felt the truck moving backwards. So he did what any one of us would do, Kelly. He scooted over to put his foot on the brake, but he instead hit the gas. So a combination of shock and force threw him up on the steering wheel, up on the dashboard. And before I know it, he's catapulting 40 miles an hour right at me with no time to react. Goes up and over the median, up and over the tree in the median, hits our car and throws me to the ground, runs over me diagonally, leaving a tire track scar on my stomach and tearing my spleen. And then continuing on to completely sever my left arm from my body.
Like gone.
Like 10 feet away. Exactly. And the next thing my mom hears is my brother saying, Mom, Brian's arm is over there. And she looks up the parking lot and she sees a string of muscle cooking like hamburger on the asphalt because it's 115 degree day, August 10th, 1992, right? And so she just goes into complete mom mode, right? Locks up everything she needs to, focuses on him, starts focusing on me. But, you know, the really serendipitous part about this, and I always have to give honor to the woman other than my mom who saved my life that day. There was a nurse that walked out of the store right when that took place. And she saw the literal life and limb scenario happen right in front of her. And so I've said for years, I'm forever indebted to this woman for her choice to go into action on that day. Yeah. You and I were talking before the show. I got to meet her on the 30th anniversary of the accident for the first time in 30 years. I'd been searching for her for a decade, right? And the first question I asked her is, why? Why did you do it? Right? She came over and she stopped the bleeding on the maimed wound to save my life. And then she instructed some innocent bystanders to run inside, grab a cooler, and fill it with ice to get my detached limb on ice within minutes. Had she not done one or both of those things, I either wouldn't be here with you today, brother, or I'd be here with you today with a cleaned up stump. That's just the reality. And so I asked her, why? Why? And she said, I didn't even think about it. But what's interesting about that is that she had a friend with her there that day, who was also a nurse, who had all the same training that she had, who turned her head and went on with her way. Now, I want to be really, really clear for everybody and you listen. Like, I've got zero negative energy, no resentment. No, that was well within her right to do that. But why do I pause and hit that point? Because a singular moment and a singular choice can not only save a singular life, but can have a ripple effect that's now going to impact millions and billions as a result of it, right? She's just an unbelievable woman, and she ended up giving me credit for her next 30 years in her career because she told my story in an interview in Atlanta Children's Hospital. Was the first question that was asked. They hired her on the spot, and 30 years later, she was serving families that entire time. So I've now reestablished this with her, but why do I say all of this? What I've learned in my time is that, dude, I've got a really unique story. Like, I know this. There's not many people I know who've had a detached limb that's reattached that have as full function as I do. There's not many, yeah. Right? I'm in a fraction of the population.
Have you met someone else?
Through Challenged Athletes Foundation, I have met others who've had similar type things.
Were they hit by a car and not a truck?
Various scenarios. What's interesting is there was a guy who was almost exact, not in a car, but there was a guy that was in the hospital that used the same surgeon I had between the ages of 7 and 9. He was about 30 at the time. I was 7. Okay. He lost his arms in a farming accident. Okay. Reattached, but nowhere near the success rate. In fact, one of his arms is completely like stiff now, was not able to get any kind of function back. And the other one, he has like very modest, but has almost no hand function.
Okay.
Right. Which shows the resiliency of a young body as well. Yeah. Right. And so it just was beautiful, but it's like, I know I have this unique story, but why I said in the very beginning is every single one of us has a unique story. Right. So regardless of the extremities of our stories, whether it's a big T or a little T trauma, right? Whether it's getting your arm ripped off or having your dad look at you funny when you load the dishwasher incorrectly when you're 9, the reality of it is it still has the same impact on our human psyche and the way that we process information and create connections with people.
What about the dude in the truck?
So he never met him, and that's one thing I wished I would have been able to. He was later in life and not well off on health, and so we got a card from him like 2 weeks after the accident and then was never able to establish contact, but that's one thing I wished I would have been able
to
do.
Say to him?
I would want him to know that I don't carry any anger, any hurt, any resentment. I would want to alleviate him from, I'm sure, the burden that he carried until the rest of his, you know, till for the rest of his days. That's one thing that I wished I would have had the opportunity to do, is to alleviate him from whatever suffering in the ambiguity and unknown of whatever happened to me, because I don't think he ever knew. Right. And I'm good. I'm happy. I'm healthy. I live a productive life.
Yeah.
Right. But it's like we need to help ourselves recognize, too, that it's like, look, that wasn't intentional. It was an accident. Right. Things happen. And so for me, there was never any anger towards anybody involved in the injury.
Ever?
No.
Where'd you learn that type of forgiveness? I mean, that's strong for a 7-year-old, because I'm thinking there was times when I was 7, 9 and somebody took my position, got to play Super Nintendo before I got to play.
So I will tell you that I remember in the first 24 to 48 hours in the hospital bed, laying there feeling sorry for myself.
Okay. Like, what are you feeling? Like, exactly what's going through your brain?
So the first 24 hours, it was like I was in a twilight zone.
Okay.
It was as if I was out of my body looking down on it and observing what was happening to me because I was in and out of consciousness. Okay. So that's my experience and recollection. It's like I felt like I was literally in between worlds. Okay. Like my body and my soul and everything were like trying to decide, where am I going to go with this? And when that snapped out, like I started to feel like, man, what is my life going to look like? Like literally feeling sorry for, like, why me? Yeah. Why did this happen to me? Right? And just starting to go through those contemplative questions. Yes, at 7, I was thinking that way, right? Like, I don't know, you can't have something like this happen to you and not take a moment to be like, why me, right? But what I think where the humility and the grounding came in is that we started being surrounded by people in the ICU, families that were coming up to us and saying, we're so sorry for what happened to you guys. We're like, it's so traumatic. It's like, what can we do to help you guys? And then we come to find out that their kid's laying in the hospital bed next to me with a terminal illness and doesn't know if they're going to live for another 30 days. I mean, I get chills every time I tell that story because my life was going to be stable. It was too early to know whether or not I'd have functional use or even if my arm would stay, remain attached, yeah. Right? Like there was so much ambiguity in those first few weeks. But what I knew is that I had my life and that was not in jeopardy anymore. And yet, I'm surrounded by a bunch of kids that are 5, 6, 7, 10, 12, 15 who are looking down the barrel at their last 30 to 60 days of life. And how could I be angry? I was just given a gift. I was given life. I was given perspective. And there's a whole lot that went into this whole story and process. But, you know, I've lost a number of people that I did work with in the hospital from a philanthropic perspective, from a speaking perspective that I was in the hospital with. And a number of them aren't with us anymore. And I still am, right? And so I view it also through the lens of I have the opportunity to carry their stories forward. I have the opportunity because of what happened to me and how I was surrounded to be able to survive and actually thrive. In a way that now people ask me, like, Brian, why do you care so much about helping other people? Well, if somebody hadn't decided to step in, I wouldn't be here with us anymore, right? Had that nurse not taken action. If I didn't have countless doctors make decisions and exceptions to work on me because I was a 7-year-old and they wanted to give me a fighting chance, right? The number of therapists that worked with me from an occupational perspective, a physical perspective, to help me understand, like, how I could utilize these things, right? My parents literally had this vision and they used to believe like the idea of seeing their son grow up without the use of his left arm was a source of great potential suffering for them. So though I was in a fog for a lot of those years, my parents weren't, bro. Like they were intimately aware of the unceasing medical treatments, years of physical therapy. I mean, 20 surgeries in the first 5 years. Wow. Right?
From the age of 7 to the age of
12.
For those of you who just heard my voice jump in, my mic, I just turned it on.
Oh,
so
yes.
This is the thing. This is the thing with life, right? Sometimes I'm impatient with understanding what the reason is.
Yeah.
So we just started off the podcast. I did the introduction. I did that. My voice is probably low. They could hear it through your mic.
Yeah.
Couldn't hear it through mine. This is like the fourth time I didn't turn my mic on. And I think a lot of times, why are these things happening?
Yeah.
And I never get the answer. How did you deal with that? As far as like, why did this happen? Because as a 7 to 12, I would like to think you were Gandhi and you were like, oh, you know, this is for a greater purpose. But at those ages, how do you reconcile the fact of when you don't get an answer right away?
Man, so I used to believe that this was my transformation story. And the truth is it was the story that created just a bunch of trash from my past that I pushed through and pushed down for years. So I wish I could tell you that I processed it all and like allowed myself to feel everything.
Yeah.
Right. The truth of the matter is when I shut off physical pain because it exceeded my ability to cope, I shut off mental pain, emotional pain, and spiritual pain for the following 20 to 25 years and didn't realize it. And so what happened to me is I got under this belief system that if I have a strong mindset, if I'm mentally tough, like I can do anything, right? But here's really what it all started to happen through. I come out of the hospital and I have a teddy bear in between my arm. My arm has to heal at 90 degrees.
Okay.
I'm cute. I'm loud. I've always had like this gravity. So everybody's coming up to me and asking me, what happened to you? They're expecting me to be like, man, I was racing my brother on our bikes down the street and I crashed, or I flew off the jungle gym, but man, you should have seen me fly. Like normal 7-year-old story. But what would I do? I'd look them deadpan in the eye and say I was run over by a truck and my left arm was torn off. Now I got really, really used to seeing people's jaws hit the floor.
Yeah.
And then about 99% of those people, once they picked their jaw back up, they would pause And they would turn to look at my parents for validation, which told me that they didn't believe me. They didn't see and understand my own truth that I'm living and existing in. And
did
my parents,
get to a point where you would joke with people about it because they would ask you so much or a silly question?
Yeah, I would start to say something like, oh, a shark bit it off, but I beat the shark, right? Like, because it was literally, it would sound so audacious in my own reality that they didn't believe me. But that also started to make me feel like I wasn't being seen and understood and nobody was going to accept my truth.
Yeah.
Because for me, my physical reality is like, what do you mean? I'm wearing what I just told you. Like, how do you, like, you're going to doubt it? Like, yeah. But they're like, no, a seven-year-old, that's too audacious. And my parents would always be like, no, no, that's what happened to him.
But at that time, too, because you were, how old are you? You said 1992 when it happened.
Yes, yeah, so I was seven.
Okay, so you were 7 years old. So in, you know, we take 5 years forward, we're still talking about what, 19, what?
It was 1997, so
1997, so you're 12 years old. At that time, being a bully isn't a bad thing. It's not looked at like today. Like today, if you bully someone, you're literally going to get pushed off the planet and sent to the moon.
Yeah.
At that time, making fun of someone for looking different wasn't an abnormal thing.
No, okay? It happened a lot.
So what were the things that you went through? Because, and I think about some of this stuff now, and I'm like, man, if my kid went through that, that would be... What were some of the things that were...
Yeah. So... Pretty much on the tail end of all those people not believing me, they would start to then view me through their lens of what they'd be capable of in my situation, immediately limiting me. Ah. So that period of time was a period of time where I
slow that down and play it back again for, for a second. Because I tell you, I think one of the things that I admire about you too is you're a wordsmith. And you're able to move through words so quickly that have so much power and so much meaning.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes it goes by so fast that a person is like, they don't even get to digest it. Yeah. It's almost like this is a bad, I'm the king of bad transitions.
Yeah.
And if a person has ever done a beer bong before, which I haven't, I've done it with a Sprite, which is the stupidest thing you could ever do.
Yeah, that's not good.
All my buddies would beer bong.
Yeah.
And I would have to do it with soda. But sometimes it's like if you don't just accept it and let it flow through.
Completely surrender.
You spit it up. It's like everywhere. You got to surrender. Yeah. So take us back to that part of when a kid views you through their lens.
Yeah.
And then you started being limited from it.
So it was adults and kids who would view me through their lens of what they'd be capable of in my situation.
And you took that on.
Yeah, because they immediately would put limitations on me, telling me all the stuff I'd never be able to do. And I, first of all, have never liked in my entire life to be told what to do or what I can do in any capacity. Yeah. Talk to my parents from the time I was born. I was like, what? Why don't you ask me to do that? Don't tell me to do that. Right? Like, I've just never resonated with that.
Do you think that's born in or do you think that that's conditioning?
I think it's both. But exactly. I think for me, it's probably born in.
Okay.
Because that was something that I had beforehand. But yeah, so kids would start, they'd start to tease me.
What would they say?
I mean, back then when the terms were all appropriate, right? I was called a retard. I was called like every name that you possibly
could.
They called me a retard even though it was a physical thing. Yeah. Okay. And so I was constantly looked at as an outsider.
Okay.
Until probably middle school, high school. I always had a handful of friends.
Got it.
But that was a hard part for me in those first few years. Cause I was more a patient than I was a kid.
How about your buddies? Were your buddies? Cause like I've got a group that's not, that's abnormal. So we've been friends since we've been in fourth grade and we're all still together.
Yep.
I was just talking with my brother before I got, before you came into the studio and my buddy Will from fourth grade, my buddy Dave from sixth grade, Dale from seventh grade.
Yep.
And there is nothing off limits.
Yeah.
With your buddies, were there things that they were able to say that no one else was able to say and give you a hard time? Or did they dance around?
And so now I'm at a place where like anybody can say anything because I don't care. But back then, yes. Like I would have friends who would tease me about this. And I had to learn to laugh at myself around it too, right? Like, I mean, as serious as and intense as I often am in situations, like it's also like you gotta find like levity in it.
Yeah.
And so I've got some really good friends that would give me shit and you know, they would always be like, oh, they'd like introduce me or we'd be like hanging out and be like, well, I know you got 1.5 arms, Brian, or like whatever, right? Like it's always been there.
At what point did you get to when you got a chance to be able to laugh about it? Because I found with things that I was insecure about, actually no one else cared.
Yeah.
Like, but I was insecure. Once I became okay with them, then it opened up this whole world. Like I didn't realize that I had a flat head.
Yeah.
And I've got no occipital bone. It's completely from top of the head to my back. Like, really? It's just completely flat. And I didn't know that until I got in a fight. Thank you, Cousin Stan. we were in a war of words, and he was like, at least I don't have a flat head. And I was like, yeah. Like, why would you say something so insensitive? And then I realized it, and I was, at first I was self-conscious.
Yeah.
And I would only face you this way. Mm-hmm. I'd never face you to the side. Yep. And then when I got to the point where I was like, hello, my name is Kelly. I got a flat head. It changed for me. Was there a paradigm everything. Shift?
Yeah. And I would tell you that the paradigm shift honestly was in the last 10 years.
10 years?
Yeah.
How old are you now?
38.
38. You're young, man. I could be your dad.
Yeah, you probably could
be. Yeah. My family's from Utah, so.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
So in the last 10 years, what happened in the last 10 years?
Just a lot of healing, okay. Right? I mean, so all of those narratives early in my life caused me to create this narrative, which was Brian's good, Brian's strong, Brian's capable, Brian can do anything himself. Right. And that, okay. That served me really well for a long time.
Yeah.
In proving to myself and proving to the world what I was capable of.
So that's age 12 to age
20.
Okay.
Right. I would say seven to 20, 13 years. Okay. There was a 13 year pattern.
You were like, if you tell me I can't do it, I'll do it. So you were basically burning negative energy. Mm-hmm. Like you were taking the dog poop and then you were lighting it on fire and being like, I'll do it. Tell me I can't.
Anything and everything. Right. Really? That's what. Everything.
You do that was silly because someone told you you couldn't, and then when you did it and accomplished it, you were like, that was dumb.
Deadlift 400 pounds.
What?
Yeah, why the fuck would I ever need to deadlift 400 pounds? It.
Someone said to you, you can't deadlift
400. No, somebody was like, oh, you're weak. You can't do that shit. And I was like, I'll fucking show you. Right? And what did I do? In that next period of time, I trained and conditioned and ultimately.
How long did it take you to do it?
Like 6 months.
You dedicated 6 months because somebody told you you couldn't do it.
Well, and I also was curious.
Yeah.
Right? That was also in a place of time where, like, I was not completely comfortable in my own skin.
Okay.
And I still hadn't shed those layers of, like, self-preservation and ego.
Yeah.
Right? And that chip that I had on my shoulder from all those people telling me all the stuff I wouldn't do, I lived my life in a lot of cases to be like, no, fuck you. I'm going to show you what's possible.
Yeah.
Right? And it was fueled probably more from a place of resentment and proving for a long, long time.
Okay.
Whereas now I would tell you I'm so centered. I'm so clear. I'm so neutralized in who I am at this point that – I love to show people what's possible,
okay.
But I don't feel the need to prove a thing.
So deadlifting 400, when you...
I wrecked my right AC joint as a result of it. Did. Yeah, screwed up my back in the process, man. It was like so dumb. I don't have a lat on the left side of my back. I don't have a tricep. I'd have to strap my left hand onto the fucking bar.
You would strap it on?
Yeah, because my grip strength is my biggest failure point. So I would literally strap it on and I would, like it. I mean, literally, bro, I would strap it on so that I could not let go of the bar. And I would just train and condition my core and my legs. I just did it. Why? There was no purpose other than to show that I could, right?
Is there any functional thing in life that by deadlifting more you can actually do?
I don't think so.
Picking up luggage?
Maybe.
Like work, if you worked at Southwest.
I would argue that the functional movement of a deadlift, right, and the hip hinge and all that is good, but... Do you need that much weight and resistance for normal? No, you don't, right? Like, you don't. But, like,
have you ever gotten to a point, like, when you had kids, you were like, baby, I got this. I'll pick them both up because, yeah, I got that deadlift.
Did. Yeah, yeah. I always. Well, I've got videos of me holding both kids in my arms.
Maybe that was it.
Yeah. Maybe. So, but no, I mean, I would do stuff like that all the time, man.
What else? What's another one that you would do? I love the deadlift one, man. Do you have any video of the deadlift?
You know I do.
You do.
I don't know if I have it for 400 pounds. I've got it in the 300 plus.
Can you send it to me?
If I can find it.
Yeah. That'd be awesome.
I know I have some videos of me doing over 300, but I don't know if I have 400 on video.
I want to send it to my buddy James. You know James Dixon?
I don't.
James Dixon is a unilateral amputee. And he deadlifted and he was a strong man. And they told him kilograms and he didn't register it to pounds. And he went in and set the state record. And I believe it was the national record at the time.
Wow.
With only one leg. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So you guys can hang out, deadlift together.
I would love that.
You know what I mean? Maybe you guys can start like
I love other adaptive athletes that do cool stuff. Maybe we can do the 400-pound club. Yeah. Yeah, the amputee 400-pound club. See what happens with that. Dude, I mean, so I would snowboard. I would drop huge drops on mountain bikes. I would do anything.
Were you going after that adrenaline rush kind of adrenaline junkie
Yeah,
stuff?
I say now. I didn't realize it then, but I had to push the limits of death to feel alive.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it was also just I mean, my rush threshold has always been high.
Okay.
But once you go through what I've gone through, my pain tolerance is
ridiculous.
Stupid. To the point that I like, if I decide, I literally can shut off physical pain in an injury.
Really?
Yeah. I got to that level of ability to be able to do it. I mean, so when I was 20.
Does that hurt you though? Because I remember a person saying a joke, like they said that if I had a daughter with that couldn't feel, like feel heat, and she put her hand on the stove, the dad would be like, oh, wow, she's a superhero.
Yeah.
The mom would be like, dummy, she can't feel it. Has there been a time where you being able to shut off pain has actually caused more injury?
All of me shutting off physical pain for the first 20, 25 years caused injury. I mean, all of that was causing damage to my body. All of that was showing up and manifesting as physical pain. You know, what's crazy, brother, is like March 5th. So what? Nine days ago.
Yeah.
Was 1 year with zero physical pain for the first time in my adult life.
Really? What type of pain? Inflammation. Like on a scale of 1 to 7.
10. For the probably last 5 to 10 years, I've been operating between a 7 and 9 out of 10 on pain.
Are you kidding me? Every day.
Every day.
Every day. Sharp pain, dull pain.
Both. I've got a multitude of injuries in my body, but I also don't have a lat on the left side of my back.
Got it.
So I have a curve in my spine, which has caused a whole ripple effect of issues.
Okay.
When I was road biking to train for an Ironman.
Oh, you did an Ironman too?
I didn't because here's what happened. I've been mountain biking for 20, 25 years, right? I've got two pivot points, elbow and here, but I don't have a tricep.
Got it.
Okay. So on a road bike with narrow handlebars,
yes,
I have no downward force on the handlebar on the left side. The only way for me to ride that way until I get the adaptive equipment that I'm going to be purchasing was to ultimately like modify my arm out like this, which was to lock it up, right? I could hold onto the bar, but what would happen then? The 150 miles I was riding every week, all the road vibration was going right up my arm into my C6 and C7 joint.
Oh my gosh.
And I blew out my two discs like 3 months before I was supposed to compete. And it took my normal baseline of pain and put it to a place where it was debilitating for a little while.
Did you shut that off too?
When I could. Yeah. I mean, it was, when I say like I can shut off injury, what I wasn't capable of shutting off was like the long persisting pains with inflammation, certain things. I would have like a 2-hour routine to get myself moving every day because I would be in so much pain when I wake up in the morning.
Is your wife that one, like my brother is that one for me that I'll literally do something and then I'll call my brother and I'll be like, hey man, my knee is hurt. And he'll be like, what'd you do yesterday? And I'll tell him what I did. And he'll be like, smack. He won't like lay with me. He won't encourage me through it. He'll just be like, why the hell were you doing that, man?
Bro,
is your wife that way?
So yes and no, because she fully accepts me for who I am. So she just like expects it.
Okay. So she expects, like, right? When you get on the mountain bike or when you get on the road bike for 150 miles, when you don't have a tricep and you have to adjust your arm, is she saying like, Brian, come on, bro. Like,
yeah. She was like, why are you doing this?
Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I would tell you that when I was training for the Ironman, there was still some proving elements.
So when she does, when she, or like your relationship with her,
because
my wife is this way too. One time we were on a ski lift and I'm horrible at snowboarding. She's great.
Yeah.
Like ridiculously good. Like through the trees, no helmet. I mean, she's gangster.
Cool.
Ski lift going. I get to the top and I freak out because there's a little bit of a drop when you get off and I stay on.
Okay.
And I've never seen someone going down the mountain on the other side on the ski lift. So I'm like, I don't want to be that dude. So as we start to go up, I just jump off. And as I jump off, my snowboard is strapped on and it goes straight into the snow and my knee pops.
Yeah.
And I'm laying on the ground. I'm like, ah, and I'm yelling. My wife comes up and she's like, are you okay, baby? Are you okay?
Yeah.
And I was like, trying to be a man. I was like, I got this. Yes, I'm okay. And she's like, good. Ha ha ha. And starts filming me and laughing at me while we're doing it.
She laughs at me as well.
Okay.
And cause she also knows my pain tolerance. So she doesn't like, she knows what I'm like, what I can tolerate and what I can feel. And she also always is trying to bring me down. Cause she's like, Brian, like your perspective on pain isn't normal. So like when someone else gets hurt, like you need to pay attention to that. Right. But like legitimately it was always those things. So snowboarding, I mean that at 20, that was another pivotal point though. I was snowboarding. I was a pretty good snowboarder. I would do trick parks. I'd jump. I'd do things. I was okay.
Yeah.
Never let this stop me. 20 years old, I caught a bad toe edge, went down, and I always knew to tuck my arms, right? Like, once you get into it, you know how to do that. I would kick in my edge and pop right back up if I ever went down. I went down, and my elbow hit funny, and I felt it snap right away. I re-broke my arm in the same spot it came off at. So I dug my edge in, and there was a ski patrol, like, 30 feet ahead of me. And I like waved him down. And this was like an example of like the pain tolerance, just to give you perspective. He comes up to me and I said to him, I said, I have a pretty complicated situation I need to explain to you. I said, I'm going to need some help.
Are you saying it like this?
That calm.
Because you've got a narrator voice anyway.
Yeah.
So, and you got a very calm voice. You said it in that calm.
Yeah.
Because you weren't screaming?
No, because I knew what needed to happen. And I knew that I was the only person in California who knew my story well enough. And so I wasn't going to hand over anything to anybody else.
You're a superhero.
And so he comes up and I was like, I broke my arm. And he goes, no, you didn't break your arm. I said, trust me when I tell you and I show you everything. I promise you, like, you'll understand. He goes, there's no way you broke your arm. You would be in so much more pain. I said, you have no idea what I'm dealing with right now. And he goes, okay. And he goes, well, if you think you broke your arm, why don't we take off your snow coat, your jacket? Take off my jacket. And there was, my whole sleeve was filled with blood. It was a compound fracture, right? So it broke through the skin. He looks at me, he goes, I think you broke your arm. I was like, thanks, buddy. But like, you know, I walked from the medic tent to the helicopter because rolling on a bed to the helicopter was hurting. And I knew I could walk at a pace that wasn't going to allow me to hurt or bounce my arm. So like, I got up there, the freaking paramedic at the time, this was before my wife was like super involved in my life, hands me a cell phone. And I call my mom from his cell phone while I'm on the helicopter. And my mom is like, so used to like,
dude, your mom's had enough, man. Bro, She's had enough.
The list of things that my mom has received calls for from people who are like, ma'am, we've got your son here. He's unconscious, like, or whatever, like multiple stories of that. So I call her and I just said to her, I said, mom, I broke my arm. I'm headed to Loma Linda. They're air evacuing me because I was at Arrowhead up in Big Bear. They're air evacuing me to Loma Linda because they've got the skill set. I said, I need you to try to get any medical records you possibly can and get it sent over to the facility ASAP. And she goes, what do you mean? I said, I can tell them everything that happened, but if you can show them anything, it would be meaningful. And so by the time I got to the hospital, the medical staff had stuff. My mom was like on it, right? And I wouldn't let them give me pain meds because I didn't want to be wigged out of my mind.
Yeah.
And so that was one of those. They had to reset my arm twice that night, like a field medic.
Yeah.
Standard procedure for compound would normally go to surgery.
Yeah.
The doctors were afraid to touch it. Wow. So they didn't. They tried to adjust it, like a field adjustment with no pain meds. That was one of the more painful experiences I can like vividly remember. And I was sitting there at the time, and I remember being able to breathe through it mostly, but I couldn't stop the tears from coming. It was excruciating when they readjusted it. And then I went 10 months with it hanging by my side. 7 surgeons who were afraid to touch me. And that was the period of my life that I started to realize the power of my narratives.
Okay.
And how disconnected it made me.
Really?
Because I was in college at the time, surrounded by friends, having so much fun, people I'd been doing stuff with, partying with, and I found myself completely alone.
Really?
Yeah.
What point was there a was
right
there
after
that,
the accident and right for the following the few months?
Really?
Right. And
was there a breaking point for you realizing this?
Yeah, it was in the first couple of weeks.
Okay, where was it? Where were you?
I was at University of Redlands. That's where I went to school.
Okay. But where were you fit? Like at that time when you realized, hey, I'm.
I was in my dorm and I was sitting because I led a team of people. I was like an RC, so I ran a whole dorm.
Okay.
So I had staff, and I was sitting in my apartment. And was just realizing like how alone I was and how nobody was coming by to see me. And here's the thing, in the beginning, I got a little resentful. I got a little frustrated. I'm like, I've been doing all this stuff for all these people. Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Bro, they bought into the power. Brian's good. Brian's strong. Brian's capable. Brian can do anything himself. But they added a fifth one. Oh, and he'll ask for help if he needs it.
Mm.
I didn't know how to ask for help. It's something I've only been learning and flexing that muscle for the last 5 to 7 years, right? In the darkest, most painful period of my life. I didn't know how to ask. So that's when I started to really focus on human connection.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like one of the next transitionary periods of my life was this idea of vulnerability and authenticity, which to your point in the beginning, there's buzzwords. But to me, those are the glue that binds human connection.
Yeah.
And so I got really, really good.
What does it mean to you? Like, because we hear it all the time and you'll hear a person will go through a coaching program.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. They'll go through it for 4 weeks.
Yep.
And then they'll be like, I'm a certified authenticity coach. And I'm like, come on, man. And then they'll be like, you just need to be vulnerable. And I'm like, I mean, that's why I love your story.
Yeah.
And even in us talking before we started, to me, you exemplify it.
Thank you.
right? So that vulnerability, does. It because it honestly, like, it's like nails on a chalkboard for me a lot of times.
Yeah.
You know, because a person will be like, you just need, they'll say the seven tag words. You need to show up in your authentic self and be vulnerable. And then when you put yourself in a space and allow that space to be able to, I'm like, come on, man.
Yeah.
You went to the exact same course that my 5,000 million other people have that are trying to sell somebody online.
Which is also why nobody knows who to trust anymore. And the world is starving for authentic leadership. So for me, what does it mean? I believe that authenticity is a few things.
Okay.
We're all born as our brightest, most authentic, burning light that we'll ever be.
Okay.
And then there's parents, teachers, coaches, employers who start saying, you should do this, you shouldn't do that, you should be this, you shouldn't be that, you should want this, you shouldn't want that.
Okay.
Narrowing us into this box of who the world has told us who to be instead of who we are.
Yeah.
Right? And so many people are privy to falling into that trap. I did. Right? To me, authenticity is getting back to the core of who we are.
Okay.
Right? And in the current state of life. So that's a process of ultimately healing pain.
Got it.
To shed the layers of armor that are protecting that pain so that we can actually allow ourselves to be seen in the world, right? Authenticity to me is congruence, right? Am I the same person when I'm with my wife and my kids that I am when I'm sitting with you, that I am when I'm on other podcasts, that I am when I was up at Steve Sims Mastermind, that I am when I went to see David Meltzer and his whole crew for dinner last night? I'm the same person everywhere I go.
Okay.
I don't have anything to hide. I don't have anything to prove,
yeah.
Right? And so authenticity to me is one of the ways that if we can get there, it's what allows us to have what I call a strong spine and a soft front. A strong spine is I know who I am, what I'm willing to do, what I'm not willing to do, my heart, my intent, my desires, my boundaries, my worth, my value, all of it, which means I can be unwavering in any environment because I don't need to protect myself, right? Which allows me then to know I can lower my armor, which means means I'm accessible to people. So if I look at my wife and my kids, they want to come to me to be consoled. Do they want to come lay their head down on a metal chest piece of armor? No. Yet we go through this world and our ego and our self-preservation protects us, or we believe it's protecting us, but it's actually disconnecting us.
Yeah.
Right. So authenticity to me is congruence.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, when you see me on video or you meet me in person, am I the same guy? Yeah. Right. And it took me a long time to get there. Vulnerability to me is, it's in the same vein. You know, I think we all suffer for four reasons.
Mm-hmm.
We suffer for the things that are left unsaid, the things that we lack permission to feel or say, the things we lack the words to articulate or understand, and the things that are left undone. And so here's the reality. If those are the sources of suffering, every time I speak my truth into the world, every time I communicate something, it's like the last scene from 8 Mile. Eminem took away his competition's, all of his ammunition, because he just owned it. He just owned all of it, his flaws, his imperfections, his greatness, right? Like all in one little beautiful bundle. And so the more I communicate my truth and the more I've talked about the anger that almost separated and cost me everything I ever cared about, the shame that almost destroyed multiple businesses and relationships, the ways that I hid from the world for so long, when I was operating in this human connection window around vulnerability and authenticity, I didn't understand it beyond intellectual. And so how I operated in that window of time isn't how I view it today. So what I did then, right? So again, vulnerability, I believe true strength hides behind it. Because now when I speak my truth, I'm acting and doing. But what am I also doing? Every time I share my story, my perspective, the things I've struggled with, the things we all fucking struggle with, right? I give people permission to feel and say things that they wouldn't have otherwise. Yeah. And I give them words to articulate and understand it so that they can now act or do and alleviate their own suffering. You know, that's such a big focus. But back then, what did I do? I got good enough at sharing just enough information about myself to get others to feel comfortable, to lower their armor so I could drive a Mack truck through and focus on their problems instead of my own.
Wow.
And I didn't know I was doing that, right?
Yeah.
But here's the reality. I didn't realize until 32 years old, 6 years ago, that what I've said to you a couple times on this show is that I shut off emotional and mental pain for 20 to 25 years and didn't realize it. So I'm sitting on the couch with my daughter in this beautiful moment. I come into tears, and I've learned to condition tears out of my world. I wish I'm working on accessing them again, right?
Yeah.
Because it was self-preservation that shut off my tears. But I'm experiencing it as joy and realizing that everything else I've ever felt in life was pale in comparison. And so now all of a sudden I'm sitting here like, wait a minute. I'm experiencing joy like this for what I believe was the first time ever. The truth is it was actually my wedding day. There's not a damn good picture of me because I don't have a good cry face, and I was a mess on our wedding day. And I didn't know it was joy then. Like I just was strong emotion, but that's what it was. I was so happy to be marrying my partner. And so my daughter gives me this experience, and I started to realize human connection without emotion isn't really human connection. was the missing piece, right? And so now it's, I used to operate from a place of sympathy, and it used to drive me crazy when my wife would tell me that, because internally I was feeling so much, but I didn't know how to express it. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't actually allowed myself to go to those places. See, when I started to unpack emotions and realize that I was shutting so many things off, I started to pause just long enough to realize all of what I was suppressing. And I would just try to extend and allow myself to feel a little bit longer. And it supports what I believe today, which is if we don't feel, we don't heal. You know, there's proof in science that's actually shown this. There's 40,000 cells in the heart called sensory neurites. They're brain-like cells that have cellular memory. And they've shown that if you go through the intellectual pattern of unpacking your past alone, and you don't embody the associated emotions, that you actually don't heal, that you actually don't change. And those same patterns will continue to repeat. And so the last 6 years has been the most exponential element of my journey, because authenticity and vulnerability to me now is, it's also the most freeing way to live. True strength hides behind vulnerability, mm-hmm. right? And so for me at this point, you know, if I understand, and I'll explain it this way just so you can see it too, I think we all seek and desire four things. We all want to feel safe. We all want to feel protected. Mm-hmm. And those are not the same thing. We all want to feel seen and understood. And we all want to feel connected, right? The second we walk into an environment that we don't feel seen and understood, protected, connected, what do? We tend to protect ourselves, right? Those 35-gallon black trash bags, right? Imagine unfolding one and holding your hands up like this. Now walk into any environment, right? You go into a place that you're networking and everybody's handing out business cards because they want something from you instead of for you. You're going back to see your family for Thanksgiving and you know your aunt's going to treat you this way, your mom's going to look at you this way, and you're going to suffer for the. And you start anticipating, right? What do? We protect ourselves. That trash bag is our armor now. So now imagine, how could I properly portray or expect anyone to see who I am, what I'm willing to do, what I'm not willing to do, my heart, my intent, my soul, my desires, delivered through an opaque force field? And that's assuming they're not carrying their own, that's going to further dilute the message. So the reality of it is the second we protect ourselves, we guarantee we're going to disconnect ourselves from the two things we want most, which is to be seen and understood and connected. See, I lived behind armor for so many years, believing that I was being mentally tough, that I had a good mindset, right? But it's so much more than that. The world's highest performers, the ones that really reach freedom, are the ones that understand their intellectual, emotional, and physical narratives. Mm. And they know how to balance, listen to, and regulate between all of them. Why? Because they will all tell you the truth, and they will all lie to you. And so it's about separating in the moment what is real for us in this time, right? That cellular reaction, which causes protection, is a direct correlation to our nervous systems, because we're conditioned to want to survive. So the second we don't feel safe, of course our armor goes up, because we're anticipating threat, risk, harm, right? 100 years ago, you cut your leg, you could die. That's not our reality anymore. So it's time to update our operating systems, right? But here's the truth. These are times like how my wife, right? When I was dealing with stuff, she'd look at me and say something like, "Hey, honey, what do you want to do with the kids this weekend?" But remember, I'm holding this 35-gallon black trash bag up. I'm not hearing it correctly. That armor is protecting my shame. It's protecting my anger. And what did I actually hear? "Hey, honey, you've not done enough to be a good husband and father here recently, yeah. So what are you going to do to make up for it this weekend?" And then what do I feel the need to do? Defend, right? Because I have to prove and justify that, no, that wasn't my intent. My intent's not being seen. So what do? I puff up. I feel my heart race, and a heat wave comes over me, and then I rattle off the 10 things I've done in the last few days to show my wife I'm a good husband and father, when that wasn't even what she was asking, right? Like these anger moments that had nothing to do with what was right in front of me, it was all because of my protection, disconnecting me from what it is. And so I had to go through a systematic process of being able to access the sources of this cellular reaction, the sources of why I had intellectual thoughts and emotional narratives that were keeping me trapped. And many of them were just a direct correlation to the physical cellular reaction. The narratives weren't real. And so for me, authenticity and vulnerability, to bring this full circle, mm-hmm. is about presence. And I've been saying for the last 18 months, which took me a long time to realize, my presence is the present. Like, I am the gift. And I believe that statement, by the way, for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's not even just about me. But I also know that all of my gifts, all of who I am, all of how I can create an impact in the life of one person or many, is all directly correlated to how present I am in every moment. Because what's right in front of us is also the only thing real in this world. But it took me a long time to realize that.
So you come out of college and you go into the professional world,
yeah.
right? And you're carrying this stuff. How does it impact you in the, getting,
yeah.
whether your first job and then into your industry?
Yeah, well, you know, I I had things I needed to prove there too, right? I had this belief that if I worked really hard, built some successful businesses, right? Like I was really in seek of who I was and wanting more connection, but I didn't have a healthy model for that. So what did the world tell me? What house, what car, what amount of money, what amount of success was going to make me significant, right? So I go into risk management, employee benefits consulting. I learned how to use my story for the benefit of selling health insurance, right, for the early parts of my career. And 5 years in, I ended up leaving and going to become a partner in a firm that I could build and scale. By the age of 27, we had built it to a $10 million practice. And it was 27 that I realized, sitting in circles of people making multiple six figures, seven figures, eight figures in many cases, that I had all the what's in the world I ever wanted, way earlier than I ever thought I'd have them. But it cost me who I was. And I found myself at 20 still isolated and disconnected, even though I'm on this path of human connection. Like, I hadn't established it at a deep level, right? And so...
Did your wife see this while it's happening? Because our wives have the tendency to have vision that a lot of times we don't have.
She did. She absolutely did. But it wasn't... We weren't in a place in our life or relationships where it was...
How long were you married at this time?
27, 2 years.
So you've
been together. We'd been together for seven at that time.
Okay. All right. Why you take 5 years to marry her?
What? I would have married her.
She was saying no?
I would have married her. She wanted to get a couple of things finished and complete in her life.
Okay.
And so we lived together 9 months in, and we basically started life together, but it was another few years before we got married.
Was your mom pressing you? Was your mom pressing you? Like, are you getting married? After 5 years, your mom wasn't pressing you?
Mama
Bogart out there?
She knew. She knew. We were communicating. I mean, I knew I was going to marry my wife the day that I met her.
You knew you were going to marry her, but was mom like, hey, you know, it's been 5 years?
My mom was old school and didn't love the idea that we lived together.
Oh, how'd you break that to her?
Over the phone? I just told her.
The phone or in person?
In person.
Would your mom hit you?
No.
No.
No. No.
Are you sure? Ever?
I got smacked when I was a kid.
Okay, that's good.
But I wasn't.
That's
no, my mom.
A good kid.
My mom doesn't hit me today.
Okay, she doesn't.
Yeah.
You have the permission to, Mama Bogart.
She does. She knows that, by the way. My mom's scrappy, man. Yeah. She could still take me, probably.
I'm sure.
Yeah, she's.
I'm sure.
She's
even
scrappy.
Though you could deadlift 400, dude, it ain't gonna help with Mama Bogart.
My mom's a beast.
Yeah.
So no, I mean she wasn't pushing me. My wife though was seeing it, but we didn't have the knowledge and understanding that we do today. And so we were going through...
Was she dropping little things? Because women have the tendency to drop little nuggets. Like, you probably shouldn't do this.
So here's the reality. My wife never liked my second company, one that we built.
Okay.
There were elements of toxicity connected to the culture. There were things that...
Break down that word, too, because that's another buzzword that is toxicity. Used all the time. And people are like, get toxic people out of your life. And I was like, then you wouldn't have any friends because you were toxic at some point.
So let me put it this way. I'll just give an example. Yeah. And I'm not going to reference the company name or anything else.
No, we won't. We'll put them in the bio, though. We'll
Perfect.
Link to their
Make
company.
Make sure you have all the links and everything. Okay.
Yes. Mama Bogart. I'm going to call her. And I can call her Mama Bogart.
You can call her Mama Bogart all day long.
Mama Bogart, I want to meet you because this dude put you through so much stuff.
I still do, man.
So much stuff. Yeah. Like, she don't need that anymore,
no,
Brian.
She doesn't.
Stop it, man.
She doesn't.
Stop it. She needs to smack you today. Like, when we get off the podcast, Mama Bogart needs to meet you at the airport in Phoenix.
Yeah.
And just smack you.
She might.
And just be like, look, Brian.
I'm going to have to record this and send
enough.
It to her and be like, my friend Kelly said so.
I recorded it already. It's right there. Okay. So tell me about, she didn't like this company that we're not going to name.
Let's put it this way. We were around individuals that probably could have been diagnosed as sociopaths and narcissists.
Got it.
Lots of ego.
Got it.
Lots of...
So you were in business.
Lots of lots of posturing.
Okay.
But also zero accountability towards damaging behavior. And so, you know, great example. The CEO.
Not to be named.
Not to be named. There's a whole nother ripple effect of this whole story that went later. And I don't want to, but there was an affair taking place with CEO and somebody that supported him directly in business. Mm-hmm. The person who directed him supported him in business was married to one of our other business partners.
Wow.
And it forced a whole divide.
Okay.
And let's just say a very significant settlement that we all ended up paying out into to protect his name. But it was also one of those things that, like, we didn't really have a choice.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was lots of ways that, like, there were really reputational things. There was a lot of mistreatment of associates. There, even amongst, you know, our collective team and partners, it was very much cutthroat, right? It wasn't about how do we help people grow. It was, what do I get from you?
Yeah.
And it was one of those environments where it was like, if you even mentioned the name of a prospect that you were going to go work on, there would inevitably be somebody in the room who's like, I know them. They're my best friend. You need to take me out with you. We're going to joint venture this. And then they try to take 50% of the revenue, right? Like, it was that kind of cutthroat model.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And it served me really well in lots of ways.
Okay.
Right. But it was.
Because you're in a place where if you're told you can't do something, you're going to go do it. You want to prove. So you're going after it.
That was literally it. And I got so much heat in the beginning because I was the youngest partner that was ever a part of the firm.
And you're going to get it.
And I was told by all these people, I'm not going to be successful. And I was like, fuck you. Watch me.
I know. I've deadlifted 400 pounds.
Right. And so, and when I left, I had a significant book. I was a third of our office and everything. So it was, you know, but it was a lot around proving, right? And so my wife, when I had this moment of pause, she saw it and she leaned into it. And that's when I hired my first coach. And a month into working with him, he said, Brian, you got to be doing this. I said, doing what? He goes, Brian, your personal story, your professional story, all the philanthropic work you do, all the money you've raised, all the people that you help. He goes, why wouldn't you get paid to speak and coach? And I looked at him and I was like, fuck you, dude. I'm paying you a lot of money not to help me, like, to help me figure out some other shit, get more intentional and aware in my life. And now you're trying to add something else to my plate. I wasn't even open to hearing it. Mm. He saw me in a light that I wasn't capable of seeing myself. 9 months later, after he trickled it for 9 months, I was given a sign by the universe that was too bold to refuse.
What was it?
Sounds insane. And every time I tell the story,
everything about you is insane. You got run over by a truck. You're still sitting here, man.
I
got on a mountain bike, locked up your arm on a 150 mile ride. Mama Bogart's going through a lot of trauma. And you tell me, oh, this was going to shock you. Ain't nothing going to shock
me today,
man.
This one sounds like much more abstract and woo. And every time I tell it, like I even catch myself and I'm like, is that really what happened? Because it sounds crazy. Every single day for 30 days, I got a text message, a DM, an email, a phone call from someone or some organization that was reaching out to me to just say, thank you. Thank you for the impact you've had in my life. Thank you for that piece of advice. Thank you for what you did in our board meeting. Thank you for stretching us from a $13 million to a $25 million capital campaign because we never saw we could do it. Thank you for, like, and the list went on.
Mm-hmm.
Every day for 30 days. It was really weird for the first week. Like, yeah. Really weird. I was like, what is going on here?
Okay, but you think that's for us as listeners or even as your friend, you think that's going to shock me? And the fact that you got run over by a truck and your arm is across the parking lot sizzling? Like, that.
Maybe it's about how I normalize my own life, because this,
maybe
to
that
me,
is.
I mean, I have a tendency to your point, like,
that's not woo to me.
I have a tendency, to your point, to brush through elements of my story because they're so normal to me.
Okay.
And keep in mind that when that happened, I was at 27 and I still wasn't connected.
Got it.
So this idea that I had had this impact in all these people's lives and that they, without prompt, without me asking, without seemingly any purpose, were reaching out to me to just say thank you. I didn't know how to receive then.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I've only learned to do in the last 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And so then it was, you know, I used to believe that, like, words of affirmation were like my love language. But here's the truth. My style of shame, there's two talk tracks. I'm not worthy and I'm not good enough. I'd be lying if I said I didn't have moments there, but that wasn't my predominant narrative. The other one is, when you shut that down, you show up in the arena, you're ready to go to battle. Who the fuck do you think you are? See, everything major I did in my life, I felt I needed to apologize for. And the bigger I lived, the more I felt I needed to pull the throttle back in my life. So when I'm receiving words of affirmation, it actually made me feel worse about myself. And so back then, I had to take that impact moment over those 30 days and really sit with it.
That's some complicated stuff inside the head, man.
Yeah, it is.
Like, say that again, but say it like I said, you are, it blows my mind because I'm thinking, I'm like, damn, maybe I'm just not that deep, because I'm thinking, like, maybe I had some trauma, but hell, that was life. And you just go through and you're like extrapolating all the, say it again, say it slow, say it with your chest.
I was largely disconnected at that point in my life. And I didn't have the ability to receive, like, period.
So when someone would give you a compliment, it would make you feel worse.
Yeah, and I would always defer it.
Really?
You know, a minute ago when you said that to me and you said you, like, embody authenticity or whatever you said.
Yeah.
And I said now, right, I fully receive that.
Yeah.
that's an intentional process for me to force myself to actually feel it and receive it. And to honor and acknowledge the energy exchange coming from the other person.
When you go through all that, that's a lot. Yeah. That's a lot of things. How do you not get tired? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Because how do you not get tired in that part of it? Because I gave you a compliment.
Yeah,
and then you said, and thank you for saying thank you again. You're awesome. Yeah. And then you said, like, I've got to consciously think about accepting it.
Mm-hmm.
How tired does that make you?
Because
that's a lot of work.
It's not that much work anymore. It was in the beginning.
Really?
Yeah. It's becoming really natural for me now, okay, in a lot of ways and cadences, but it's, you know, I've got these three words tattooed on my arm because...
I didn't see any tattoos on this arm, and I was wondering why you hadn't tatted this arm up.
These will be the only three words on this arm.
Ever.
At the current... I'll never say never.
Why?
But I will tell you that that's my plan for now.
I don't think you could ever tattoo that arm.
I don't think I will.
I'm just joking with you. I thought you would maybe do it.
No. I mean, so here's the thing. The reason I never wanted to is because I look at the scars are the stories that were chosen for me, and the tattoos are the stories I chose for myself.
Ah, okay.
And so the distinction and contrast between my body is, like, pretty interesting, yeah, right? Like, what's funny is I meet people all the time, or I'll be on stage telling my story, and people somehow don't recognize my arm. To me, it's so bluntly obvious. It's, like, so boldly obvious. It's 4 inches shorter. It's smaller.
It's not that obvious, though.
And this is what I hear from people. But to me, I look in the mirror and I see the difference. And it's not a comparison or judgment difference. It was for a long time. Now I see the beauty in it.
Yeah.
Right? But when I was 20 and I'd walk around with my shirt off, what did I want to be? I wanted to be buff like all the other guys. And I wasn't able to develop this pec because I don't have a tricep. And there was a lot of things I couldn't do with weightlifting that just were different, right? Yeah. And so what would happen my whole life if I had my shirt off or I wore a tank top? Because I live in Arizona, I love coming to the beach. I spend 40 plus days a year out in San Diego because I love it out here. I love to be, I don't hide it. But what would happen? Most people would laser focus on my arm. And then I started to get tattoos. And it was really interesting. People get confused and they don't know where to look because they're drawn to the art and they're drawn to the stories. But then when I don't have a shirt on, they're like, wait, where do I look? And so it actually has led to even more conversation, and more people will ask me about my tattoos that will then lead to a story about my arm, then will ask me about my arm. Most people just stare. And so...
What should a person not ask? Because I think for the person out there, like, I was taught from a very early age, if you see it, ask about it. Like,
yeah, me too.
And I do. Like, if I see somebody without a leg, I just want to know.
Yeah.
And so some, not all the time, but most of the time... They appreciate the curiosity.
Yeah, I always do.
Is there the side, though, that you're like, I asked a Navy SEAL the other day.
Okay.
I said, what shouldn't I ask you if I meet you? He was like, body count. And I said, he said, because there's so many times people think of us as SEALs or as, you know, special ops, and they instantly think they can ask that question. And I was like, oh, wow. But it helped me to be aware of it. What shouldn't a person ask?
That's a really good question, and I haven't heard it phrased that way. So I want to honor the question that you just asked me. I'm drawing a blank. I would actually rather empower people with a way to ask anybody anything.
What about little kids? When you have a kid, because there's a lot of times where you want to snatch a kid up, because your little kid would be like, hey, mister, you got a shorter arm. And, you know, you want to snatch a kid up. Should you be snatching the parent up and allow the kid to ask because of curiosity?
So I think that most kids are actually coming from a place of wonder and curiosity.
Yeah.
And so, like, doesn't even faze me. I have kids all the time. They'll just make an observation. It's like, oh, man, your arm is smaller. What happened? But us adults, like, feel like, oh, what happened to your arm?
Is that more awkward?
Staring and the hesitation is way more awkward.
So just going in.
Yeah, just ask. Because here's the reality. You know when somebody's looking at you, right?
Yeah, of course.
We're all aware of it.
What is the advantage of it? Like, my buddy James, he jokes with me all the time, and he's like, hey, man, we need to go to a concert together. And I was like, why? And he's like, dude, I always get the good seats.
Yeah.
And... So what's the what is some of the advantages that you've seen that sometimes until people know you, they don't realize, like, you can joke about it now.
Yeah,
you can laugh. You can all the stuff. What are some of the advantages?
I think what it's developed into is I have like a really, really deep level of empathy.
Okay.
And I've learned to be able to be in environments to allow others to feel safe and protected.
Okay.
And so for me, one of the advantages has been like, you just have kindness flowing through your world. People just do things randomly for you, right? And even sometimes if they don't know your story, because I've had to tell it so many times, or because I've been put on the spot, or people have judged me or limited me, you know, even connected to this concept of receiving, it's like I can just operate with heart. And that took me years to do, but it's given me an ability to see people in a way that most can't.
So early on, was it sometimes offensive to you when a person would overly, you know, hey, let me help in this. And you're like, nah, I could do this myself.
What I never liked was people who would just make assumptions on what I couldn't do.
Okay.
Right.
Now do you take it? I mean, is there sometimes
I get it and I understand the context. I don't get worked up about that, to be honest. You know, what is interesting though, is it's like,
what are some of the cool things that you're like, you used to stop someone from doing and now you're like, oh, let me just go ahead and let them do it. Is there anything?
So yeah, actually last night was a great example of it. So I used to be really embarrassed that one of the most challenging things for me to do, believe it or not, is cutting steak. Because I don't have a tricep. So unless I'm standing above it, like on a cutting board with a big old butcher's knife and I can just slice through it to hold the meat down, even if it's a really tender piece of meat and a really sharp knife, I don't have the same thing as like the riding the bike. I don't have a tricep to put downward force on it. So the way I have to cut, I'll be shaking the frickin' table, right? And so there were times early in my life that I would struggle to cut my steak in a professional environment or dinner because I had too much pride and ego to just tell somebody, this is one of the things I struggle most with. Do you mind taking 2 minutes and cutting my steak for me?
Yes.
Or being looked at funny when I would order a steak in a nice steakhouse and actually ask it to be pre-cut, and they'd look at me like I was crazy. And then I'd half the time be like, well, I had my left arm ripped off, so it actually helped me a lot, right? But last night, I just ran into somebody, and I sent him a message on this last night. I dropped into David Meltzer's dinner. I wasn't going to eat because it was just on the 405 right off, and he's a buddy, and anytime I can be around him, I want to be, right? So I pop in, and I knew a bunch of people in the room. There was a guy there that in October at another event that we met at, I was just really upfront and honest with him, just a heart-centered guy, just like unbelievable human. Last night, he saw I kept getting pulled into conversations, and I wasn't planning to eat. And he says, hey, Bogart, come say hi over here for a second. And I come over, and he had half of his steak cut up on his plate and had gotten an extra fork. And he said, I knew you weren't planning to eat, but I also knew that if it was cut for you, you'd probably sit down for 2 minutes and eat it. Wow. And I sent him a message last night, bro, because like, it's such a small percentage of the population that would think that way. To just serve and to just do it completely out of heart with like zero judge. He remembered from 6 months ago that I couldn't cut my steak and he helped me one night and he proactively cut a steak so that I would eat.
Wow.
So, I mean, those are all advantages, right?
Do you ever take advantage of it?
I would tell you that I have in moments.
Have you ever have you ever reached for the check and been like, oh, I can't reach it? And then
So I have a buddy who legitimately has alligator arms. Uh-huh. I mean, he's got more resources than many people I know, and he's the last person to ever there was absolutely a time like he's got alligator arms and I went and I was like, bro, I can't, and he's like, can't you use your other arm? And I was like, no, I can't.
I'm left-handed,
so man. No, I mean, there's absolutely times I don't like, I'm at the place now. Like I just love to fuck around with it myself.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't.
When's the last time that you like, a stranger where you kind of gave him a hard time?
Oh, shit. Last night it was real quick. So Flex Lewis was there. He's a buddy of mine.
Yeah.
And I got to meet Bruce Cardenas last night. Yeah. He's got a
great last name.
Gem of a human being.
Phenomenal.
And look at the synchronicity. I ended my evening with him last night, and I'm seeing you today.
Great dude, too.
Right? He gave me a box of legendary pastries yesterday, which are bomb.
Yeah.
Right? I've been eating those for a little while now. But, there was this interaction with Flex and him.
Uh-huh.
And Bruce said, well, Brian, like, what do you do? And I hadn't told him anything about my story. And I looked at Flex, and I said, Flex, why don't you tell him what I do? He looks at Bruce and he goes, he's in porn. And so then I said, well, I said, Bruce, I said, what you need to understand is, I said, yeah, I mean, I've got like this on this side. But I said, I mean, look at the left side. I was like, I draw attention when I'm on camera. He starts dying laughing. And he looks at me, he's like, well, there's a lot of money in porn. I was like, you're telling me, bro. And then I looked at him and I was like, nah. And then I told him what was real. But it was like just last night, I played into Flex's prompt on porn and used both arms to be like, I mean, dude, I've got two different sizes, right? Like, I've got 1.5 arms. There was somebody, I mean, I was in a mastermind last week and I can't remember. So one of my favorite things to do is when someone says, man, I feel like I was hit by a truck. Like super common saying, right?
And at first, did you used to get offended by that?
No.
Because I've asked my friends with diabetes, right? I have friends with diabetes. And there's a joke a lot of times where if you eat too many donuts, you're like, that tasted like diabetes. Yeah. I asked them, is that offensive? And they were like, sometimes, but now I laugh at it.
Most people don't even think about being hit by a truck, though.
That's what I'm saying.
Right? So, no, I've never gotten offended by it.
No,
this has been one of my favorite things for people to say to me, like...
Do you call it out?
Every time. Because I'll be like, man, I've been there. That really sucks. I was like, all I know is it took me a long time to recover from that, so just let me know how I can help you. And they'll look at me, and if they don't know my story, they're like, what are you talking about? And then I'll lean into it. And if it's like friends of mine, they're like, fuck you, Bogart. Steve Sims, right? Yeah, I went to one of his first speakeasies. He had an axe throwing competition. I can't throw axes with two arms. I don't have a tricep.
Oh.
So I threw axes with one arm. I won the competition out of 50 people. In the semifinals, I had to go from the small axe to the big axe, and I hit it in the bullseye, right? And so he's like throwing this, you know, so he the other day said something to the degree of, like, he goes, yeah. He goes, don't let that fucking one arm act fool you. He goes, he won our axe throwing competition. I said, whoa, 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 Steve. It's 1.5 arms, bro. Like, look, you got to have fun with it, right? Yeah. And I don't, like, again, I don't have anything I need to hide or defend anymore.
Talk about the transition too, because when you go from, say you were working in the one company that we're going to put on the bio, you were working in that and then you transition.
Yeah.
Some people have a hard time with transition because identity, like their identity is in this place, whether it be in the financial part or whatever it is. How'd you deal with that? And how'd your wife deal with it?
So there wasn't any identity tied to that world that I was aware of in the last 3 to 5 years, because that was something I worked really hard on from the time I was 27 until the time I left, which was really getting centered and clear on who I am.
How long from the time that your coach that you brought on till you actually did it?
5 years.
Wow. That was wild.
And so
it's
20,
like your marriage, like you have a 5 year thing.
Yeah,
a thing?
I don't, I mean, I guess there's, I like patterns.
Did
I like,
you shack up with this dream before you? Did you live in sin with this?
I did. 5 years side by side. Yeah, I'm running my other business.
Mama Bogart, I want to apologize for this too.
Yeah.
Living in sin twice.
Many more times than twice. Okay. But here's the thing. Like 2019, my wife and I went away for a quick weekend and I had some other health stuff that happened that year. And she looks at me and she goes, how would you feel if you didn't have to go to the office on Monday morning?
Your wife says this?
Mm-hmm. We're going to pick up our kids. And she just drops that bomb on me. And I'm like flooded in my fear. I'm like swirling in my shame. I'm drowning in my doubt all in that moment. And I laugh. And I was like, babe, that's a loaded.
Hold on. Swirling in your shame. Did you actually use that in your head? Because that's not a normal thing to say inside. You said I'm swirling.
In the moment, I did not. What I was doing.
But you said it now.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, that's not a normal.
Because I was spinning inside, literally.
No, but swirling in your shame is not a.
There's a lot of things I say that don't seem to be normal, though, bro.
But I'm saying, like, that's even more abnormal than getting hit by a truck. Like, I don't know anyone in my life that has ever been like, dude, I was swirling in my shame.
I did for years.
You did? Okay. Yeah. But did you say it? Like that?
No.
No, you didn't.
No.
What were you thinking?
I looked at her and I literally said, babe, that's a loaded question. Why don't you tell me more? That's literally what I said. And she went on to tell me, she said, Brian, I think you've allowed fear to enter into your world in a way I've never seen you operate.
Wow.
She said, I think you've convinced yourself that we need the money, the status, the prestige.
Okay.
Right? Because that's the unconscious part of what I was doing. I felt like if I built a life of significance, people would just want to be around me.
Yeah.
Right? And so she's like, I know you've convinced yourself we need this. She said, but we don't. She said, I don't care if we live in a cardboard box on the corner. What we need is 100% of you and we don't have it.
Damn.
And then she went on to say, I also know that every time I see you operating in a coaching and speaking capacity, you light up. And she said, and I think the more time you spend in insurance, you're dying a little bit every day. She said, I don't think you're having the impact in the world that you want, and I know you're capable of. And she said, and I know for a fact you're not even scratching the surface of your potential.
Oh, my God.
And so she said, the bet I would make 10 out of 10 times is a bet on you. She said, we've done it before, and it's paid off. She's like, why don't we double down on that bet and go see what we can do in the world? 10 months later, I left my company.
Wow.
So it was 3 months of, like, really needing to sit in it. Like, when I say I was swirling in my shame, like, all of the doubt, the self-worth, the who do you think you are narratives, all of it was going on, right? Like, I had unbelievable doubt.
Yeah. Does it generally take you, like, 10 months to listen to your wife?
It takes, no, so it takes me a lot longer than that in most cases. Joking. Dude, it took me, no joke, like, probably 10 years of marriage to actually understand what she was trying to communicate to
your
me about
wife
anger.
Is a gangster.
My wife's a badass.
What's her name?
Ashley.
Ashley.
Yeah, there were periods in
Ashley, you're a gangster.
There were periods in our there were periods in the times when we had tension that I believed that my wife was weak.
What have you never told her?
I don't know that there's something I've not told her at this point. We're so transparent now.
What do you not tell her enough?
It's more about the areas that I communicate without words that I can improve. Caring for my wife is the greatest way for me to demonstrate love for her. And that's typically through physical touch.
Yeah.
Right? Rubbing her feet, rubbing her back, holding her. I do that often, but she deserves to have it more. Okay. So yeah, no, it took me a long time. I mean, I say today, my wife and I have been together for 17 years.
Yeah.
We hid from each other for 14 and convinced ourselves in that window that we were in the best place in our marriage we'd ever been multiple times. And my wife's only felt emotionally safe with me for 24 to 36 months.
What was the turning point for that then?
Yeah. So I left June 1st of 2020, 10 months after she gave me this challenge.
Okay.
And the whole goal at that time.
She's a patient woman too.
Unbelievable.
She waited 5 years for you,
bro,
man.
She's
five
unbelievable.
5 years for you to marry her.
She's unbelievable.
10 months after she told you. Like, I mean, that, what she said was gangster.
Yeah. Well, I needed to finish the fiscal year, and we both knew that.
Okay.
So it was, the 10 months wasn't, I wasn't listening.
Why is
it
a fiscal
year? It took
year?
3 months for the.
Why is it a fiscal year? No one's ever been able to tell me the justification and the background of why a fiscal year is actually in place.
Okay. So.
You're going to tell me?
Well, I don't know if I'll tell you in a way that you'll understand. I'll tell you from my understanding.
Okay.
And for me, I'm going to answer it in the realm as why finishing that fiscal year was important.
Okay.
Okay. Because of the way our partnership worked, we would set what we called splits.
Okay.
That we would pay all of our partners out on a proactive basis throughout the course of the year. At the end of the year, we would evaluate where we were as it related to the percentage of split that we paid out.
Yeah.
Because we were projecting profit margin.
Yeah.
Right. And then we ultimately would reconcile. Meaning, if we crush it, which we did every year for 10 years, we'd pay out huge dividends at the end of the year, as well as huge bonuses to our folks. And so when she communicated this with me, I was already 3 months into a current existing fiscal year.
Okay.
And I am loyal to a fault.
Got it.
And I also like to finish what I start.
Okay.
Okay. Now I walk away if something's not in congruence, but for me, that's what it was related to. Less about my business partners, more about my associates.
Okay.
Because I knew what I had going on that year. I actually wrote, I doubled the size of my book in the final 10 months. I was there after 10 years of building it. And it's because everything after a decade came to fruition. So I had a really amazing exit. But that was my goal, is I wanted to set them up for success after I was gone. Because I was the keeper of the culture. I was 30% of the revenue in our office.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there was a lot of things that took place. We had 60 associates that were all, like, reporting up. And so, to me, leaving anything earlier than the end of a fiscal year that I'd already been a part of budgeting, all of my numbers were contributing to people's bonuses and payroll, and I wasn't going to leave them hanging because I had this epiphany.
Got it.
Right? So I used that 10 months to clean everything up and transition, as well as start to lay a foundation for me to leave. Okay? But the whole goal of it was for me to leave to be able to go help people get to the core of who they are.
Got it.
And then, ironically, almost exactly 10 months after that, it was April of 2021. So I left in June. April of 2021 is when my wife and I sat on our back patio. And she went on to describe to me the ways that I showed up, things that I'd done, patterns that still existed as a result of me, had created a path that caused her to lose who she was. It was, it was a dagger to my heart. And
did she set it up like, hey, we need to talk and we're going to set aside this time?
We had some stuff that we unpacked in the prior 6 weeks,
okay,
which led to it, which was important.
How long did this conversation, did she go right in?
Yeah.
Like you sat down.
Because she was at a place where, it was literally like a shit or get off the pot moment. Mm. Had I reacted in that moment like I'd done so many other times, I guaranteed I wouldn't have been married 30 days from then. But I received all of what she said, probably because of the way where I was at in that point in my life, but also how she presented it. And so I paused immediately. We sat out on the back patio.
How did she present it?
She literally said it almost identical to what I shared as far as I can remember. And, you know, one of the things that we'd been sort of focusing on for a couple of weeks prior that was more that was contributing to the anger that we had to kind of clear out is her perception of what she used to receive as control from me, which was never my intent. So I'll give an example of what I mean by that. I grew up in a house where there was one right way to do everything. Mm. I adore my parents, but they are extremely particular. They are very anal in the way they operate with everything. Mm-hmm. And I knew very, very well, very, very early, the right way to do everything. And so when Ashley and I first lived together and moved together, right, like she would be like loading the dishwasher and it would be said just like this, right? Like, hey, babe, have you ever considered like loading it this way?
Aye, aye, aye.
I was trying to help. She receives it as control. I was blind to some of those narratives that were there, but like it was that kind of stuff. So we ultimately got to a place that the control became very, very clear and she was able to understand the intent. So that got removed. And then we sat in the anger. And the anger, I never verbally abused them. I never hit my kids. I've spanked them, smacked them, but I've never like abused my kids, right? Yeah. But dude, I've got a big energy. And I have ability to infuse life into people. Mm-hmm. Imagine that flipped 180
Extract
degrees.
It, yeah.
And even if it's not directed at a person, mm-hmm, right? If the doorbell goes off and our two little chihuahuas would start to bark and I got on sensory overload, it would present like anger because I'm like tensed up and all of this, right? Well, if I don't know that that's happening and I don't find a way to let go and release that energy relatively quickly and I walk into the other room and one of my kids jumps in my lap, what energy are they getting from me? And so, you know, it was really, so what happened in the moment is I handed my phone to my wife and I said to her, I need you to get with the teams, clear my calendar for the next 10 days, and I need you to hold on to my phone for the next 10 days. 2 days later, I went out and I bought another phone that we called my booty call phone for a while because the only person who had the number was my wife. And I wanted the phone so that I could communicate with her, but I wanted to block the rest of the world out. And I had to go deep inward for 10 days because I made a promise to her that day that I was going to do everything in my power to ensure the negative effects of anger would not affect our house as a result of me again.
Wow.
I was just in tears the other night in a moment when I was having this conversation because the idea that I've ever done anything other than make my family feel protected and safe still crushes me. Because it was never my intent. And I genuinely was blind to it. I'm a big believer, and a lot of our waste to wealth methodology supports what I had to go through to find these places, but I'm a big believer that if we don't get to the source or sources of what's causing our reactions and start to unpack them, understand them, and actually understand not only the lessons we can extract from them, but what are the narratives, what are the ways that I'm reacting, how is it showing up and moving through my body, If we can't start to understand those things, then we're always going to be in a reactive state. And we will be in a reactive state in an unconscious way that we don't understand even what we're reacting to. Great example. One of the major sources of my anger, I was given a little bit of a gift in a somewhat traumatic way as well, 5 days after this conversation. There's another five for you. I took my kids And
going to Vegas after this,
bro,
man.
Like, let's go. We're going to put everything on five.
Five.
I dropped my kids off at school, and my kids, like, I'm a father and husband first, period. It's the only thing binary in my world. And they give me so much light, so much love, and, like, the way their brains work is just phenomenal. And I've got two special needs kids that have different neurodiversities, which makes them even more remarkable, in my opinion. Uh-huh. And so that was great. So we have this amazing trip, and then I'm coming back, and I approach traffic and a complete stop in the road. And I'm one of the people that's getting up close enough to it to see it. And I feel and experience a lot in every room and environment that I'm in. Mm-hmm. And I was, like, intimately aware of the medical staff, the emergency vehicles. There was a pedestrian accident where a kid was run over by a car. For obvious reasons, I'm sure you can imagine that unleashed some stuff for me, and the timing of everything, I believe, is perfect when we allow it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a coincidence that that happened to me 5 days after my anger conversation with my wife. I'm feeling and experiencing the kid on the ground, the parents that are trying to pull him up, like, all of it. And I got a complete I went into a panic attack. Like, complete, like, hyperventilation. Images running through my brain that I've never looked at, seen, or considered. Like, stuff flashed back to me. And it was crazy. I get home 5 minutes later, and I walk in, and I'm bawling. I'm in tears. Like, can't hold it together. And my wife and I, keep in mind, this 5 days after we unpacked anger, like, we're not, like, super lovey at the moment. Like, we're trying to find center, and I'm like, recognizing all I'm going to need to do to repair. But she immediately knew something was off, and she's tried to talk to me, and I couldn't talk. And all I could do was get into a fetal position in my bed and just sob for, like, 90 minutes. And she got behind me and just held me. Getting goosebumps as I say it. That 90 minutes followed by the shower I took right afterwards, that 2 hours was unbelievable in pointing me towards places I needed to focus. It allowed me to start to understand some of the connecting fibers to my anger in a way that I hadn't before. It allowed me to realize that my relationship with my body wasn't healthy. It allowed me to realize that pain had become a part of my narrative. To the point that I didn't ever believe I wouldn't be in pain. And yet I told you I've been a year now without any physical pain. So that was kind of the beginning of it, but I had to really start to unpack and understand those things. What I'll say is, in the following 18 months, I knew I'm human. I knew it was going to happen. I made the promise to her that day, not that I would never do it, that I'd do everything I could to not. And it happened 3 or 4 times in the following 18 months. And in the following 18 months since then, it hasn't happened really at all. 6 months, I ate shit. I ate shit because I realized that as the man with the big masculine energy, I was creating damage in my home because of how I showed up that I wasn't aware. I saw fear in my kids' eyes that same period of time, mm-hmm. which crushed me. Fear in their eyes, because they think that dad's going to do something just because I was scary. Why would I ever want to scare my kids? Never. And so all of this created such deep levels of repair. You know, that's why I say she's felt emotionally safe with me for 24 to 36 months, but we've reversed generational patterns in our home. And there was an unfortunate experience a year ago that I won't go into details on, that forced a conversation with my kids. And there was an area I was still carrying some guilt that was alleviated about a year ago. They don't even remember having an angry dad. So to the lens of, like, showing people what's possible, mm-hmm. I went from believing I was in the best place in my marriage I'd ever been to not knowing if I was going to be married for another 30 days to eating shit while my wife would react on me and I would just have to, like just absorb it and take it for a few months. Mm-hmm. She grew up in a house with a dad who broke furniture when he got angry. He never hit her. He never screamed at her. In fact, he's this docile, like, almost Buddha type man. But 30 years ago, he'd break furniture. Mm. Big masculine energy has a deep trigger for my wife that we weren't aware of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we hadn't even talked about it until we started to unpack my own anger in that way. And so is that part my fault? No. But that's what I say to everybody, is the trash from your past is not your fault. It's generationally patterned. It's inherited. Mm-hmm. But it becomes your responsibility once you become aware of it, or you start burying others in yours. So I had to realize that I needed to stop dumping trash on my wife in all these moments that were creating damage. 6 months in, she took a breath and she said, I think it's time I do some work. And then it's been a path we've walked together since that point forward, which has only taken us deeper, like more intimacy, more trust. And what's really cool is like we're at a place now where things that used to trigger us between each other don't even register anymore. Right. And we've worked so well to be able to see each other, understand each other. And it's like now we empower each other with different language. Right. If my wife says something to me today and I feel something, I'll just pause and I'll be like, hey, babe, I felt triggered by what you just said, which tells me I didn't hear you correctly. Can you pause and restate it so I can try to hear it through a more neutral lens? And if I'm not capable of doing so right now, can we maybe pause this and revisit it later so that we don't create damage in this moment? Right? Like the thing is if there's damage, ownership is required and repair is the only way to neutralize and diffuse the energy and start to bring people back together. But if that damage continues to happen time and time and time and time again, then there's no trust. There's no foundation that's underneath it. So what were we doing for 6 months? Reestablishing trust so that she could believe that I could be in a non-reactive state. So that she could feel like she could say what she wanted to say always without having to anticipate walking on eggshells. Because I had reacted in so many little moments before that didn't even register for me, right? Because my intent was never aligned with how my actions were coming out. Wow. And so no wonder the world didn't see me and understand me. Because why? Because the world will never judge you based on your intent. The world will always judge you based on your actions. And so this was a moment of creating congruency in our life that I just had to go deep. And, you know, again, literally, it's one of those other areas. I shine possibility in the light of possibility. Do you know how many marriages, relationships, long-term experience, so many of the dynamics of what I just talked about? They don't talk about it with anybody. They don't talk about it with each other. They believe that it's not going to be possible. They divorce, they separate, they leave, they create all this other damage. There's hate, there's reactions. If what you want is clear and you live congruent to your beliefs and you live as congruently to your intent as possible, you really can have everything. And that's what I believe today.
What do you want your kids to know about Pop?
I want them to know about Pop that he loved unconditionally, that he lived in a way that gave others permission to live the lives they want, that humanity is really all we have. And there's so many places that are toxic, are difficult, are divided, but we're really not that far away from each other. And so how do we allow my kids to understand that Dad learned to become objective and non-judgmental? To meet people wherever they are and be able to walk with them on their journey that way. Because I'm a big believer, and my wife said this to our kids, or my wife and I said this about our kids when we had them. We really only had a couple of things that we wanted to make sure that we were successful as parents. We're screwing up a bunch of shit, I promise you. Right? And I tell my kids this all the time. I'm like, you guys are going to be unpacking stuff with somebody 20 years from now that I don't even realize is happening today. Right? Like, I just want you guys to know I love you and I'm doing everything I can to be better. But we always said we want our kids to know who they are.
Yeah.
We want them to be able to love who they are. We want them to be able to advocate for who they are. And we want them to know that they will be loved unconditionally, no matter what, no contingency. Their love, their connection, their validation through us isn't contingent on anything other than just being. And if those things can happen, then our kids can help others discover and step into who they are. They can love others, and they can advocate for others, and they can also love unconditionally because they know what it looks like. And so I believe that we're on that path. you know, we were just up again. We were up at the speakeasy with Steve and we were on the boardwalk. I was staying in a different place than the rest of the group, but we were walking at night one night for dinner and we ran into a few of them. My kids, if they see somebody and they can get the vibe that they're good people, they just become family. So like people that they'd never met, I know them, right? Some of them I'd just met, but some of them I'd known for a while. Every person that we stopped into, if they knew that they knew Dad, my son invited them all to dinner. He's like, you guys want to come to dinner with us? We'd love to have you. Right? And like, does that create some awkward moments sometimes for people? Because they're like, well, I'm headed somewhere and your 10-year-old just asked me, like, do you really want him inviting people?
Yeah.
And like, my wife and I are at the place now where we're like, why would we ever want to diminish his light and his love? Because all he's trying to do is bring someone in his family and make them feel connected. Yeah. Right? Which is what and how we live. And so I want them to know what congruence looks like.
Yeah.
In practice.
I think you're doing it, man. I mean, it's incredible, you know. From the time, even from before we started recording, I got a chance to be on your show. And the things that I heard about you, you hear about people and it's like, you know, you hear it from a distance. Okay, that's cool. The first time that I got a chance to be able to interact with you was this morning before, I mean,
Yeah.
And, it's amazing because there's very seldom a time where a person will speak about what they want their kids to experience and what they're projecting or what they're actually doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that congruency with you is, you know, is phenomenal, man.
Thank you.
So I started the podcast because of my two kids, Maddox and McKenna, and mm-hmm. I didn't want them to worship idols because growing up for us, not having internet, reading like Bop magazine, I remember I sent out I was in love with Brooke Shields back in the day. So if she's out there, Brooke Shields, you know, call a brother. Don't call me after 9 because my wife will punch you. But Brooke Shields was my thing.
Mm.
And so I remember getting like a Bop magazine and in the back of it, it was like you could write to Brooke Shields and become a part of her fan club. And I was like, yes. So I sent it out. And man, Brooke Shields herself sent me back a picture
that
she had autographed. Maybe it was a print, but in my head at that time,
she made it up just to you.
She had signed it.
Yeah.
Now, it didn't look like ink later on in life, but to me at that time, it had just dried different.
Yeah.
So Brooke Shields autographed to me personally from that Bop magazine for only 99 cents.
That's amazing.
But at that time, I remember I was a big Michael Jackson fan, too.
I'm a huge Michael Jackson fan.
I got the doll in the office here.
We're looking at it.
Oh, yeah.
We're looking at it
afterwards. Because we're going to record after this, too, for
okay.
you. So the reason why I say it is because I had these idols. I was like, oh, my gosh, if I could meet Michael Jackson. I'm glad I didn't meet Michael Jackson at that time because I was in fourth grade. My parents probably wouldn't be happy now. And I'd probably be talking about some trauma that you were talking about earlier, too. You know what I mean? I would have went on the roller coaster, but, you know, it came with a price.
You would have had fun, but you're paying for that fun. Yeah.
Yeah, that and R. Kelly.
I can love Michael Jackson and still acknowledge that. He doesn't necessarily live in all the ways that I believe her.
Yeah, I believe that too, man. And I was a big R. Kelly fan back in the day, but hey, you know what I mean? I pick them bad.
Yeah.
But I had these like almost this not idol as far as like worship them, but I had these idols in my life. Hulk Hogan, the Iron Sheik, you know what I'm saying?
Like
being able to get an actual Transformer, not the Zybots that my parents bought me. But I didn't want my kids to worship idols. I just wanted them to be inspired by icons.
Yeah.
And iconic people to me are people who, exactly what you're talking about, as far as they live congruent. It's not that they have a certain thing. It's just what they talk. They only talk about what they do.
Yeah.
Right? They don't talk about a bunch of nonsense that they don't actually practice. And I want to compliment you on that, man, because you do. And
thank you.
So what advice would you have for Maddox and McKenna? And if you could call yourself Uncle Brian that got hit by a truck, it would work out well. So started off with Uncle Brian.
Uncle Brian wants...
No, Uncle Brian that...
Wait, what?
Uncle Brian that...
That what?
Got hit by a truck.
Oh, you want me to get
the whole
don't
have an uncle that's uncle, been hit by a truck.
Uncle Brian that got hit by a truck and has 1.5 arms that I've told many people was bit off by a shark and I fought. Yeah, that Brian. I'm that Uncle Brian, that guy. the one who deadlifted 400 pounds to show the world that I could, even though it never served a purpose. That guy, that same guy. Yeah, that's that Uncle Brian. That's the one that everybody's going to remember now. I was a little slow on the uptake there, bro, but hey, I got you now.
You weren't present with me, Brian. I told you.
I was.
I prompted you, man, but you weren't present.
I wasn't. I thought I was present, but it was
not giving me your presence.
There was a lapse of it, and I took away the gift.
Mama
it's okay.
Boger, can you smack him for that one too? Okay, so let's start it over again. Do the take. Here it is. All right, and scene.
Uncle Brian, who was run over by a truck and had his arm told off, wants the two of you
told off.
Torn
you,
off.
You
did I say told?
Told.
Told.
Okay. Take three.
Hold on. Did I really say told?
You said told. We'll go back to the tape, man.
All right. Like, here we go.
Okay. All right. I'm throwing the
this is official.
I'm throwing the challenge flag on you right now.
Remind me their two names again.
Maddox and McKenna.
Maddox and McKenna. Okay.
Okay. Scene.
Maddox and McKenna. This is Uncle Brian. I was run over by a truck and my arm was torn off. And what I wish someone would have told me earlier in life is that if I didn't feel, I wouldn't heal. If I didn't find a way to communicate about any of the little bumps, levels of resistance, emotions that made me feel yucky and didn't fill my heart, no one told me to talk about it. Talk about it. Normalize it. Communicate about it. Because the more you do that, you'll realize the less you have to hide and the more others will actually follow the light that you're shining instead of you being stuck within your own shadow.
Brian, you are a gangster, man. I mean, it is unbelievable. Like this time, I got to talk to my buddy James. He prayed for us before we actually, before this happened. I called him. I was on the way to Starbucks and he prayed about this, and it's amazing to be able to spend the time with you, man.
I'm so grateful for the opportunity, dude. I love you. I love your vibe. No pun intended. But truly, like I knew the first time we got on the phone. I knew when we jumped on that you were real. There was something different, and you're somebody I wanted to explore with, my friend. So I'm grateful that that it was a two-way street.
I ain't deadlifting. I ain't gonna deadlift at all. What we do have in common that I don't listen to my wife a lot. So. What's her name?
Ashley,
we want to apologize to you. I want to apologize to you for him waiting 10 months to listen to you. Mama Bogert, I want to apologize about the living in sin that Brian did. There's something about the five too, man.
I don't know what it is.
We gotta look into that. Maybe that's your next book.
So here's the interesting thing with the five. There is one other connection. So we got married on
5/5,
our fourth anniversary, our fourth anniversary of being together, okay, on the same date.
Got it.
So our first anniversary, I gave my wife a gift because our first wedding anniversary was 5 years together.
Ah.
And so I got her a ring that matched the other, like her wedding ring and her engagement ring. And on the inside, I had first and fifth engraved. Sounds like a football term, but the reality of it is she's like, it was our first marriage wedding anniversary and our fifth year together that we actually got married on the fifth year anniversary of us starting dating.
Oh my gosh.
I hadn't even thought about the five thing there, but there was another one.
That's why I'm a good friend, man.
Dude, you showed me something I didn't see in myself.
I draw these things out.
You just shined a light on this reality.
I reach in to the depth.
You showed me the patterns about myself.
And I pull it out, man. I draw it out, man. It's been amazing, man. And I want to tell you that you're officially off the hot seat.